Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Joaquin Hortal. He's a biogeographer and community ecologist working at the Museo Nacional de Ciencias Naturales, the Natural History Museum of the Spanish Scientific Council in Madrid. He also collaborates with the Center for Ecology, Evolution, and Environmental Change of the University of Lisbon and the Department of Ecology of the Federal University of Goiás in Brazil. And before, he worked at the University of the Azores, University of Copenhagen, and Imperial College London. He studies the effects of current and past environmental conditions and ecological processes on the geographic patterns of biodiversity, the role of species niche and ecological interactions in the organization of biological communities in time and space, and the use and misuse of biodiversity big data. He works with mosses, seed plants, vertebrates, and insects, and has been studying the ecology and biogeography of dung beetles for more than 25 years. So first off, thank you for your work in the world. Second, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you, Derek. Thank you for the invitation.
So a lot of this other stuff I would love to talk about too, like the relationships between geography, ecological processes on the geographic patterns of biodiversity. But for now, I'd really like to focus for a moment on dung beetles, because I think dung beetles are incredibly fascinating, and I don't think most of us hear about them very much. So can you do sort of a evolutionary history of dung beetles? Start with that. Like, when did they – how long have they evolved? How old are they? And then talk about their niche, their role in their ecological communities, et cetera.
Okay. Well, dung beetles are one of the most diversified groups of beetles in the world. And it is not completely clear when they started to evolve. I mean, it dates at least to the early Cretaceous. So it's about 115 or 130 million years ago. And it is believed they diversified from another clade. There are two kinds of scarabs. We've got herbivorous scarabs and feed on plants or on pollen, and we've got the dung beetles, which are, they feed on dung. And we believe that from a common ancestor that was a detritus eater that was processing, I mean, rotten food, etc., it evolved into utilizing the dung of dinosaurs. It is not 100% sure, but I mean, we are perhaps we are 95%. The last paper came out a few months ago, and we are 95 to 99% sure that they started to diversify a lot with the dinosaurs. And after the dinosaurs collapsed, they are able to exploit. Some of them are able to exploit the dung of birds and lizards. That's why we know they can use that kind of feces. But when they started to diversify, a lot was when the mammals started to occupy the land. At least the ones that we now know, most of them come diversified with the mammals after the extinction of the dinosaurs. They have diversified in almost all continents except for Antarctica, of course. And they not only, I mean, their main feeding strategy is to use dung from mammals, although some of them can use other types of dung, but some of them are able to, and they are found sometimes in corpses, for example, in dead corpses, and some of them are able to use leaf litter, okay, to feed on leaf litter. So they have this mouth that allows them to shred the leaf litter or the more leafy parts of the herbivorous of the dung of the herbivorous mammals, and they can filter all those particles and all the liquid on that. They recycle the dung, and actually they are we may talk about that later, but they are key in the cycles in many cycles of the carbon and nitrogen cycles in many ecosystems.
So This is one of the questions I'm really interested in, but this is way too soon. I'm going to ask it anyway, is how specialized are many of these dung beetles? Are they generalists that they will eat any poop that comes down, or are many of them specific to, for example, elephants, that's the only dung they eat, or bison or whatever?
No, they are not. I mean, there is certain degree of preference. And you find, for example, of Ontophagosaurus, which is one of the most common ones, is most, I mean, you find it in more abundance in horse dung, for example, but they are able to feed on many other types of dung. So there is a certain specialization for some dung beetles which are able to feed on dry dung pellets, for example, from those small pellets from sheep, from rabbit, which are not that easy. They don't have those pellets don't have that many water. They are drier and harder. So many dung beetles can't use the dung, but a good portion of them can. So it's kind of being able to process different palatabilities of dung rather than a single species. So they are pretty generalist, that the thing they have several preferences. Also, many of them are only able to process herbivorous dung, the ones that go to carnivorous dung from carnivorous mammals. The number is smaller, but if you go from, instead of focusing on Europe, you focus on, for example, on the neotropics and on South America, the ones that are feeding on monkey dung and other and the high diversity of mammals that you find in the South American ecosystems, they are more generalist than the European ones. Okay, so it varies a lot. In general, they are mostly generalist, but there is some kind of specialization according to palatability.
So you keep mentioning mammal dung, and are they not particularly partial to, say, bird dung?
Yeah, the thing is that if you... we need to talk about dung if we talk about dung beetles. So if you think about the different types of feces, of excrements, the bird dung is really the guano. It's quite concentrated, has a lot of nitrogen, is difficult to process, and that is more difficult for them to process. Some of them can, but they are, most of them prefer to use massively the feces of mammals. But for example, if you go to Australia, the native in Australia, there were no big mammals before the arrival of Europeans. So they the fauna there was more adapted to use leaf litter, the dung from some small marsupials, and the dung of the big birds, etc. So actually, when the Europeans arrived and when we took the cattle there, there wasn't a fauna of dung beetles well adapted to use these large quantities of dung. Okay, and that created an ecological problem that they had to solve, because most dung pads remained they were not recycled. So they remained in the pastures, and they have to import, since the 60s to the end of the 80s, more or less, they had to import over 50 species of dung beetles to help them recycle the cow dung, actually, cattle dung.
And we don't really have to go very far here, but I'm always a bit nervous about introducing exotics into a habitat. Have the dung beetles created any problems there?
Not really, because I mean, there were already dung beetles. Some of them were doing something, but the thing is that when I'm not defending, I mean, perhaps if this was if this project was designed right now instead of 50 years ago, it may have been different. But the thing is that the exotics were the cattle, and the cattle were processing a lot of pasture, of grassland, and creating huge dump pads that nobody was being able to process. I mean, ants are not as effective as dung beetles are, because dung beetles, we can talk about that later, but they are ecosystem engineers. They open the dung, they bury it, they make some soil aeration, so it gets more productive, and everything was lacking there. So I mean, the whole the Australian ecosystems were not able to process this huge amount of dung, and actually dung beetles were beneficial in terms of recovering the kind of healthy pasture state, and since they didn't displace too much the native dung beetles, because they were using a niche that wasn't available before, which is the processing of dung. All this with all the reservations, because since the 2000s, I think there was a second Australian dung beetle project. In this case, they were focused on assessing the distribution of dung beetles, how far they had spread, etc. And arguably, the impacts were not too high. The problem is that we didn't have a good picture of what we had before. Okay. So we believe the impact hasn't been extreme, but we are not able to assess whether the structure and functioning of the previous communities remains in the areas that are not used by cattle.
So this seems an area that both you and I are very interested in is ecological niches. And
yeah.
Can you introduce people to that, using dung beetles as your example, and talk about, and maybe jump into the ecological engineers, because I think this is just an incredibly fascinating topic.
Yeah, well, niche is a kind of complex is. It's not that complex if you take it lightly, okay? But it can get really complicated. So I try to stay in the simple part. The niche is like the conditions where a species can live, and with the species with which it interacts, okay? It's those things. It's the abiotic conditions where the species can have a positive growth, population growth. They can reproduce and be successful. And also in the interaction with other species, which if you're thinking about an herbivorous species, is the kind of species they feed on. And in the case of the dung beetles, that part of the niche is the kind of dung, the different types of dung, some palatabilities of dung, and other dead matter that they use, okay? And the abiotic part of the niche, the conditions, is the environmental conditions, is the climatic conditions where they can live, the type of soil they can use, because they many of them bury themselves they make their nests below ground, a good portion of them, and so on. So a species niche is where they can live, and the part of the ecosystems where they interact, okay? And in that part of the interaction, there is another, what we call now the part of the ecosystem functioning, and what we call ecosystem services, which is all the functions that those species have in the community. Depending on the authors, this is not part of the niche. Some authors believe that it's not part of the niche. Some other authors believe that it's the extension of the niche. Okay. It's a byproduct of the niche. But anyway, they have the niche determines its, their functionality, what they are doing and how well they are doing it. Okay. And if you,
which is,
yeah, please,
which is always the part that interests me most, is how is this species helping the larger community. That's always the part that fascinates me the most.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's jump to the functions they do. I'm going to make sure that I don't forget anything. They play a major role in nutrient cycling. Okay. Well, because they actually get a byproduct of the mammal digestion. So, and they take dung, this trash, and they recycle it. And what they do is to recover all the carbon and the nitrogen, etc. They remove large proportions of dung, of that, and they bury it. Okay. So when they bury it, they do something that, which is called bioturbation or soil aeration. Okay. They remove the dung. So it's the same process as plowing, actually. We plow because we use the plow to introduce some air and change the conditions in the highest layers of the soil. Okay. And that helps plant growth. And we know that they help plant growth. Okay. We've got many evidence from experiments and field observations that they help plant growth. And they also disperse seeds. So imagine that you're a seed and you co-evolve for hundreds of millions of years with dung beetles. So if you are buried being a seed, together with a bit of manure, because actually is what they are doing, a bit of manure, they are buried at a certain depth. You've got some manure, some organic matter there to grow that helps you grow. So they have a positive effect on, they have positive on plant growth and on seed dispersal. They also, and that's quite important, they have influence on other dung associated organisms, so they can control flies, which is quite important. That was another reason for the dung beetle, the Australian dung beetle project, because they had a problem with flies. Nobody was controlling them because they were also new to the Australian ecosystems, and we don't know exactly why, but where dung beetles are rambling around in a dung pad, flies don't nest. Okay, so they don't put their eggs, and the fly larvae don't grow. So they are able to control flies, and they also regulate other parasites and have other effects. Like a tiny group of them are predators of some groups, but that's very others are pollinators. Actually, their sister group. Many of them, the herbivorous beetles, scarabs, the herbivorous scarabs are, many of them are pollinators, and a few dung beetles can also be pollinators. But the main effects are those. They are really, really central in all the recycling of matter and energy in pasture lands and also in tropical forests.
So I live in a redwood forest that is it's a temperate rainforest. Are there probably dung beetles here?
I'm pretty sure they are, yeah.
Okay, so let's follow some poop. So a bear eats grass and seeds and a little bit of meat. It eats whatever the bear eats. And then it poops. First off, how does the dung beetle find the poop? Do they have a great sense of smell?
Yeah.
And do they walk or do they fly? And how far do they come for this?
Yeah. Well, they have like the antenna are like claps. Okay. They have like three claps that are really sensitive to smell. Okay. So if they are active, there are periods of time, especially during winter, is what I told you about the conditions. And many of them, there are some of them that can live during winter, but many of them are more active in springtime or during summer. Their antenna allows them to smell the scent of dung. And then they are really, most of them, there are some of them that are flightless. They are not wingless. they have their Elytra fused, okay? But most of them are really, really good flyers. And actually we know there is a, this is, there are some evidence that, for example, Ontophagus baca, another dung beetle, when it was introduced to the US, there are records of dispersing 50 kilometers a year, which is really a lot. And actually we know that some individuals can fly in a single fly, well, almost a kilometer. And if you've got wind, even more. But anyway, they are really good flyers, and they, so they fly to seek for the dung. And then there are some differences between the fauna that you've got, for example, in North America and Europe on one hand, because they are adaptive. We probably have lost most of the dung beetles that were living in the forest. Why? Because most of the big mammals living in the forest have disappeared already from the northern hemispheres. Okay. So the fauna we've got in those areas, or in regions like the savannas, like the Cerrado in Brazil, or the, which is a savanna, or the African savannas, are species which have a smaller eyes, okay, because they don't need the eyes to fly away, and they are the lower part of their eyes is larger, so they can locate the dung pads. Okay. On the other hand, if you're talking about forest dung beetles, the ones that are in the Atlantic forest in Brazil, or in the rainforest in Africa, they have bigger eyes because they have to fly throughout the forest. Okay. So they are really good flyers, but with those two kinds of flying, that poses some problems about thermal regulation, etc. That when you are flying in deserts, when they are flying in deserts, sorry, they have some strategies of opening the legs to dissipate the heat, etc. Okay, but those two are the main types of flight. Okay, and then what they do is that they are good flyers, but they are not good landers. Okay. So when they are nearby the dung pad, they smell it and they see it. They just close their elytra and they fall down, basically. And then they walk. That's the thing. There are some variations of this. And actually some dung beetles in the forest do perching, in the rainforest, do what we call perching, which is they stay in the branches of the trees or of large bushes in near pathways where mammals pass through, and they wait for the mammals to poo and to defecate, and then they go there, and they make a short flight and do that. But that's the main trick. They land nearby and then they approach the dung. But the thing is that depending on the region where you are, this process takes very few minutes. So if you are in one of the highest peaks of activity, which in the northern hemisphere is roughly in springtime, in end of summer and autumn, if you are in the highest peak, it takes very, very little to start to see dung beetles coming in. They are quite fast.
And so then my understanding is that there are sort of three categories, I believe it is, of what the dung beetles, what the beetles do with the dung then.
Yeah. Well, there are in fact four. Okay. Because we also have parasites there. So there are three main categories. Well, as you said, one is the what we call the dwellers. Okay. That dwell in the dung pad. So they get to the dung pad, they feed there, and when they nest, they make a kind of small, they nest right below the dung pad. Okay. This is an area which is quite protected if the dung pad is not removed, but they make the nest in the interface between the dung pad and the, and the, and, and the soil. And many of them don't even make the nest there because their larvae are eat roots. Okay. So they fly away. They feed on the dung and later they fly away and they put their larvae nest to roots and the larvae feeds on them. Okay. Those are the dwellers. Then we've got the famous rollers, okay, which is the ones that take portions of the dung and roll it away. They make a ball and roll it away. So we call it paracoprids. They take it away. Okay, we call them telecoprids. It's how they take it away, and then they find a place. Usually it's a place, they find a place a bit away from the dung pad. Usually there's a place where there is a rock or there is a kind of uphill, small uphill, part of the soil, and they dig down, a large nest. Okay. And they put the dung, below. Those beetles have parental care. So the couple does that usually. Okay. The famous scarab, the sacred scarabs, for example, of the Egyptians are this type of roller dung beetles. Okay. And we've got what we call the paracoprids, which is that they make the exactly the same, but without rolling the ball. So they make the nest right below the dung pad and they push balls of dung and they into the nest. Some of the nests are very simple. It's just they dig down and they usually go a bit to one of the sides, and so the nest is not completely vertical. And they make a chamber where they leave the dung pad and they leave the eggs within the small dung ball. And the larvae feeds when the larvae appears, it feeds on the dung. But others make really large nests. And actually, there are some nice example of fossilized nests from the dinosaur period, actually. And then they have several chambers with different, with different balls with eggs inside. And then some of the telecopies, the rollers I told you, they have parental care. In some cases, the female remains there taking care of the balls and the larvae, and actually dies there. Okay. And that's why I don't know if you wanted to talk about this later, but that's why the ancient Egyptians thought or used them as a personification of their god Kefer, which is the god of the resurrection. Okay. Because they saw the dung beetles bury themselves at the end of the autumn season or whatever, or before the dry season, and appearing again. They didn't know they were different dung beetles, with different individuals, and appearing again younger later on. Okay, this process is what this process of resurrection is actually the life cycle of the scarab dung beetles. They are called sacred scarabs or scarabeus.
That's really great. Thank you. Mm. So do most of the beetles only live a season?
No, it depends. Many of them, yes, they live a season or a year. Many of them live about a year, but some of the big ones, those scarabs, for example, the males, because as I told you, the female remains there doing the parental care and dies. The male can live 4 or 5 years. Up to 4 or 5 years. So most of them are, they have like, they can have 1, 2, or 3 reproductive rounds per year. Okay. Depending on the region, on how dry is it, on how, I mean, they mostly reproduce many of them in the rainy season, because it's the most productive time in terms of dung, or in terms of grass, and then in terms of dung. And many of them are able to live for a couple of those seasons, 2-3 of those seasons, which makes a year. And some of the bigger ones can remain for 3 or 4 years. Yeah.
So how many dung beetles might be in a healthy population with a big pile of cow poop or buffalo poop or water buffalo poop or elephant poop even? Like, how many dung beetles might be in there? Are we talking 200, 2,000?
Thousands. That depends on the moment of the year. But there are records of elephant poos are 3-4 kilos. I don't know how much is that in pounds right now, but it's really huge. And there are records of those big dung pads being removed in less than 2 hours by thousands and thousands of beetles. And actually, if you go in the right moment of the year, for example, around here in Spain, in the mountains, is in autumn, in the fall, you can see the dung pads moving because of the thousands. I found well over 4,000 dung beetles, of the tiny ones, of the ones that only feed on the dung. They don't bury. Plus a couple of hundreds of the ones that do bury themselves, in a single dung pad, for example. It's not uncommon to that. In other moments of the year, you only have a handful of them or several tens of beetles.
So did you say that they can get rid of an entire elephant dung pad in a couple hours in the right season?
Yes. Well, I'm not that familiar with African seasonality, but I believe it most of the year in the areas where we have elephants, etc., in the savannah, that's throughout most of the year, actually. Yeah.
That makes me so happy that. That's one of the things that I love, is learning ways that that these natural communities have everything works together so much that you have this pile of poop, and which on one hand is a good thing because it's nutrients, and then the larger community has this problem of, how are we going to disperse it? How are we going to not let it sit here, like you said, with the cow poop in Australia? Yes. And what an elegant solution this has arrived at, is to have all these creatures come in. And that next question is, so what happens? So beetles are converting this into their own poop and also converting it into the bodies of beetles. And then who eats these beetles?
Well, many birds, and many mammals. A good example is foxes. I mean, it's foxes or magpies, or if you're used. I'm pretty used to the European pasture lands, because I mean, around where I also live outside town, and around here there is a lot of free ranging cattle, and actually if you walk by, you can see the small crows, the magpies, etc., going to feed there especially in the right season. So many birds eat those beetles, and many small mammals also do that. So it's not really uncommon to go and to see small mammals going to scavenge or to actually feed on the beetles that are going around there. And of course, there are, if you go to a dung pad that has been there for a couple of days, you've realized we're talking too much about Dunk, but it's in many ways it's fascinating because the Dunk, those big Dunk pads, solidify in the outer part. So the outer part solidifies a bit, but they remain, mostly not liquid, but, humid inside. So inside it, a lot of things are happening, and there are other predator beetles going there from other beetle families, rough beetles, for example. And when you open a dung pad after a couple of days, you realize that you see small parts of dung beetles. You see the rough beetles going around there. Hydrophilids, which is another group of beetles, also going around. It's like a lot of things happen there. Okay, it was a micro ecosystem that appeared in a given moment when the cattle or the horse put there, and a lot of fauna go there. You have very little dung beetles. The fly larvae go there and occupy it. But if not, you've got this kind of predator beetles going there. Sometimes you've got a magpie eating a big dung beetle, etc. And when the dung beetles fly, they are predated by many, many birds and mammals.
So I know this is a bit too just sort of functional, but it just, again, I love how the community then converts the poop into bird food and into fox food and into beetle food. And then that gets converted back into poop, which gets converted into, I love those cycles that thrills me to even think about.
Yeah. If you think about that, and it's, you've got tens, not to say hundreds or thousands of species involved in there. And actually it's a kind of, I mean, I don't like to call it an equilibrium, because we are used to talk to call it equilibrium, but it's a very dynamic thing that it depends on which species has larger populations in a given place, which species has been suppressed, whether you have put some antiparasitic treatments in the cattle, which kill some dung beetles, and then others are taking are growing with higher populations. So it's pretty dynamic, but there are hundreds of species involved in this tiny microcosm, and that also connect to the rest of the landscape. Yeah.
So it let me know where my logic is wrong, that one of the reasons that they may have evolved to roll some of the dung away might be that if a dung pat is going to disappear possibly in a few hours, you want to create a stable place for your babies. So that might be one reason that evolved. Is that making sense? Because if it's going to disappear quickly, then if you lay your eggs right there, it may be gone before your larva fully develop, unless, or am I missing something?
No, that's completely true. It's many species go to the dung for feeding, and if you take a portion of dung and you bury it, you protect your larvae, the eggs and the larvae from other species to use it. And actually there is before that you mentioned the three types of dung beetles, and I told you there's a fourth one. Well, the fourth one are nest parasites. They are called kleptoparasites. They actually, when the rollers are rolling their balls when they are burying their balls, they go and put the eggs inside of those balls, and the larvae grow faster. Well, they hatch before the others, and those parasites are able to use that dung that has been protected, and actually that has been protected from other species to use, and also has been buried, and the conditions in the soil are more humid, are more protective, less temperature variations, which are and are better for the larvae. Actually, different than beetles bury their balls at different depths, so to match the better the conditions that are better for the larvae. So yeah, that's a really good motive for that. It's quite likely that this is the case.
And when exactly do they lay their eggs on the ball? Do they do that while it's moving, or do they do that once it's
yeah, when they have the nest chamber already set up, they go and go round the ball. They go round the ball. Probably they are putting some chemicals that protect the dung from other parasites or I don't know, a carrier, other things. And then they mate, and they put the egg inside once the chamber is finished.
So we haven't mentioned how big are these? What are the sort of the smallest they generally come, and what's the largest?
Well, the smallest I can tell you can be about a millimeter, 1-2 millimeters. So they are really, the smallest ones are really small. And the bigger ones can probably go over 3 centimeters, something like that. Which is relatively big. Well, or yeah.
And one of the things that people might have heard about dung beetles that's just fascinating is that some of them use the moon to orient themselves. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. Well, that's relatively controversial. Not all of them can do that, because we've got one of the things that the dung beetles have used to diversify, or one of the access, the environmental access they have diversified throughout, is the daily activity. We've got diurnal dung beetles, we've got very few nocturnal dung beetles, and some of them that appear in dusk, for example. And it seems that, at least in Africa, some of them are able to use the light, the polarized light that comes from the moon, for orientation during flight in the savannas, for example, some of the night dung beetles, some of the nocturnal dung beetles. So they can use that polarized night as a beacon to move throughout the savannah. It's not, there is some controversy about that. There is some good data that indicates so, but well, it's a, yeah.
So we haven't really talked about the larger issue, and we're getting close to running out of time, but yeah. how does everything we're talking about mesh with your larger work of like one of the things you say on your website is understanding the organization of biological communities in space and time. I have the long-term aim of developing a general framework for the community ecology and biogeography, which would integrate all the processes that generate geographic patterns of biodiversity. I just think that's incredibly fascinating, too. Can you give us just a taste of that, sort of using dung beetles to move out into it?
Well, actually, I've studied many aspects of that beetle. So I studied their ecological role in Sana, and how they help, how fast they remove, and the influence of having one species and not others, and particular traits which are which help processing the dung better, or doing some functions better than others. But I'm a biogeographer. I study distributions and species distributions, and actually I use dung beetles. Well, I use dung beetles. I love it. We understand pretty well what happened with them, how they dispersed after the glaciation, how they reoccupied, for example, Europe, and why there is a higher diversity in the south, and the impact of glaciations on the on the northern communities, and so in the northern communities we've got more generalist species dispersing faster, species that are able to use colder to grow in colder environments. Okay, and I'm trying to link that over the long term. I'm trying to link that with how the species that are present in a given place are providing some functions, or are helping the ecosystem to function, or having a particular role in the ecosystem, and how the different species that are present in other region are performing the same functions but in a different way. Okay, that's one of the things that I studied, and I actually moved to use to work with other groups like mosses, etc., because dung beetles are pretty good at coexisting together, because you can find two species that are similar, quite similar ecologically, feeding on the same dung pot. Okay, and they are not excluding each other. So I went to study mosses, for example, to see which is the effect of being together and having to compete for space for the particular, to grow in particular places at the small scale. Okay. With dung beetles, I'm studying the movement, how they move around, and how the different characteristics of the species that are arriving or present in a given place, are contributing to how that place functions, how the ecosystem functions in that place compared to other with a different pool of dung beetle species.
Thank you for that. And I know you answered this before, but can you say again, are a lot of dung beetles specifically only feed on dung, or can they also feed on like dead animals?
Yeah, they many of them, as I told you, they filter things, so they can feed on rotten things and on dead animals, and sometimes, for example, one of my peer, my former PhD students, he recorded a scarab dung beetle, one of those, rolling a small dead lizard in Morocco, for example. So they can go and feed, and some of them are even able to feed on acorns, for example. So they are quite specific on using dung, but they have some plasticity, and they actually go to corpses. Yeah. And some of them are used as indicators by forensics of the time the corpse has been, the time the body has been dead, for example. Very few species that are more common in dead flesh.
You know, we haven't talked about, we talked about the life cycle itself, but how long does it take for many species how long do they spend in a larval stage?
Well, in the larval stage, a couple to a few months, they spend a lot of time in egg stage. Okay. So the eggs are, they pass either the dry season or the winter season, the cold season. Mostly as eggs, and when the conditions start to improve, they are actually they're lagged. Okay, there are some cues that makes them start to hatch, and the larvae to start to feed, and that takes, I said, a couple of months, but is more like a month or so. Okay, that creates a problem now with climate change, etc., because those cycles are being altered, and actually you can, some of them may be appearing in moments where we used to have rain and we don't have rain anymore, or the rain is later or the rain has been before, they don't match with the phenology of the year, of the climatology of the year. Okay, but actually that's the thing, they spent several months as eggs, but quite often this whole period takes between 6 months and a bit less than 1 year.
So we're getting close to done. And is there anything that you've wanted to talk about that I haven't given you the chance?
No, I think we've covered mostly everything. I don't know. I had some curiosity when we talk about the Egyptians, There was this Dan Beetle ecologist, French Dan Beetle ecologist, who went to study Egyptology. Okay, and he's got the Yves Cambefort was the name. He has the theory that actually the pyramids are down paths, and all the corridors and that are below and the chamber where the mummies were actually mimicking the nests of the dung beetles. That's how important these beetles were for Egyptians. Okay, because they were quite important in processing some of the dung they had with the cattle, for example. So that's the thing. It's not only that dung beetles have been co-evolving with mammals and before with dinosaurs for millions of years. It's also that they have been co-evolving with us and getting into our culture from the very beginning, from the beginning of the human culture. I think that part is fascinating, and it's a really nice hypothesis. Yeah.
Oh, I love that. So that would be a great point to end, but I thought of another question, which is, so mm-hmm. let's say somebody lives out in the country, and let's say they go to a cow pat or, you know, elephant pat or whatever, whatever part of the world they're in. Mm-hmm. And if they see beetles, how can they, are there identifying characteristics that you could tell a dung beetle from some other beetle if you're looking? How would you identify?
Yeah, well, the most definitive one, because there are different families, some of them are more elongated, other are more oval. The most easy one, and it's not easy because of the size, is the antenna. If the antenna have like claps at the end, so it's a short antenna with claps, they are most likely a dung beetle. They also have the clypeus, the head is like a shelf for excavating. So if you see that they have the head for excavating and really strong forelegs, it is also quite for excavating. It is quite likely that it is a dung beetle. Once you get used, they move in a certain way. They go around in a certain way. But the antenna and this kind of shelf with the head and the strong forelegs are quite characteristic, actually.
Well, I'm not making this up, but I'm not just being glib. I'm gonna take a magnifying glass out the next time I go in the forest, and then when I see beetles, which I do quite often, I will get down on the ground and look.
Yeah, you can actually use some dung pads. You can just, I mean, you don't have to manipulate them. Yeah, you get used, so you can use gloves, of course, but you can just kick the dung pad and see if there are some holes below, and those holes are most likely from dung beetles. Yeah, and probably if the dung pad is relatively fresh, you can see the dung beetles going around there.
That's great. Well, thank you so much. This is all so interesting. And I would like to thank you for your work in the world, and I would like to thank you for being on the program. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Joaquin Hortal, and this is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.